are many reasons why one cares about a city. Why you care about its problems, its people, and indeed its very future. Is it friendly, warm, hospitable? And are there good job opportunities, educational facilities, and a cultural center? Are you proud to call it your hometown? When you come right down to it, I venture to say you'll all agree to a resounding yes when you're talking about Detroit, my hometown.
That's Smokey Robinson and the Miracles with I Care About Detroit, their 1968 love song to the city that made them and multitudes of others famous. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Thursday, November the 14th, and caving under intense pressure, President Obama announced an amendment to the Affordable Care Act that will allow about 3.6 million people who saw their insurance policies canceled by their old companies being allowed under a special provision to keep their old policies for up to a year. It continues. And on this day also, an effort by hardline Republicans in the House introducing articles of impeachment against Attorney General Eric Holder, saying that he has lied to Congress and failed to uphold federal law. The point man on this is Texas Representative Pete Olson, who drafted the articles of impeachment, saying that Holder, who since 2009 has failed to comply with a congressional committee subpoena to supply certain documents that were required in the bungled Fast and Furious investigation, that he also failed to enforce federal laws dealing with same-sex marriage and prison sentences for certain drug crimes, and that he chose arbitrarily to prosecute or not prosecute people under federal law, including an official in the Internal Revenue Service, who was targeting conservative political activists. So the drama continues, but we'll talk about President Obama and his latest patch to the Affordable Care Act. But we return to our discussion on Detroit. And of course, we have our guide, who did a phenomenal job in giving us a great deal of on-the-ground background on what's the situation in Detroit. And, of course, we'll be referring to him on an ongoing basis to get some idea of what's happening on at the grassroots level. His name is Abayomi Azikiwe. He is a Detroit organizer for the Workers World Party, editor of the Pan-African Newswire, and organizer of Moratorium Now, a grassroots group seeking to halt foreclosures, evictions, and utility cutoffs for struggling Detroiters. Abayomi, thanks again for being with us. You there? Oh, there's something, we're having some difficulty. There's with his line. So as soon as we get that, he's with us, he would be with us shortly. We're having some trouble with the line. So I can kind of let you know that this situation with President Obama and Obamacare, it is a total mess. And of course, he held a news conference only about 15 minutes ago or so. And in it, of course, was trying to be very firm, very collected, and very much in charge. At least that's the PR part of it, to look in charge, even as things are falling apart. And you get the distinct impression, of course, that you almost have a sense, you almost have a sympathy for the president, like this, a guy who's clearly being very poorly advised and who is carrying out an agenda that has very little to do with the benefits accruing, the real and tangible benefits. Of course, this is being touted as a health care policy, but it actually is an insurance policy. The state is in the business now of selling insurance. There's no real plan here for health care delivery and an improvement in health care delivery. Were we able to contact our guest yet? Is he still kind of with us or not with us? Okay. Wow. Okay, so we have a problem. He's in the field somewhere, and it's very, very tough for us to get to him. So I want to talk about one thing before we get into this discussion today. Perhaps just a note to the engineer, perhaps he might be able to call in. I'm sure you've told them that too. We'll see. All right, we tried to connect with our guest, and we're having some really bad phone problems. And it's on his end, something is going on his end. I should let you know too that that's one of the issues in Detroit. Cell phone towers may or may not be working. I mean, the newly elected mayor was just announcing with great pride that he thinks he can get the street lights to work again. More than almost 50% of the street lights in the city are not working. So it's a very bad situation. It's really an okay. He's with us. Abayomi,
Yes, I'm here. I don't know what's wrong with my phone, but anyway,
how are you? Okay.
I'm here,
Well,
finally.
I'm glad you could join us. Well, you
Yeah.
have a new mayor now, and the first task of the new mayor is to find ways to be a mayor, because, of course, Detroit is now operating like a U.S. colony. How? What was going on?
Well, the elections got a very very small turnout. I've heard estimates as low as 12% up to 24%, and a lot of that is due to the fact that the mayor and the city council now have virtually no power. So really wasn't a strong incentive for people to go out and vote because the two candidates that were presented to the electorate had no real history of addressing the real concerns of the city of Detroit. There was the former police chief who is currently the Wayne County Sheriff, Benny Napoleon, and of course Mike Duggan, who was from Livonia, who moved into Detroit and could not qualify for the regular ballot and ran as a write-in candidate and spent $3 million in a race that for a job that only pays less than $200,000 or around $200,000 a year. So you can get a pretty good idea of what the elections were really about. And Duggan does not have a history of progressive politics. He comes out of the Democratic Party machine, and he also was CEO of the Detroit Medical Center. And when he took it over, it was a nonprofit entity, And during the course of his tenure, he sold it to a private corporation based in Tennessee. He also prevented the Michigan Nurses Association from organizing at the DMC. They were trying to unionize the nurses at the medical center, and under his leadership, that was not possible to take place. So that just gives you some hint as to what Duggan's background is and what real authority will he have, and his willingness to work with the governor as well as the emergency manager.
But it does say something about the fact that here is, I mean, race politics is politics.
Yes.
Duggan, nonetheless, becomes the first white mayor of Detroit in almost 40 years. And it must say something about the fact that people in Detroit who have every reason to be, having a great antipathy toward this the business as usual politics, that they should decide that it doesn't matter. They're moving really with respect to their interests as opposed to an emotional vote.
Yes. I think the total, according to the Electoral Commission, was that 74,000 people had voted for Mike Duggan, and I believe 60,000 had voted for Benny Napoleon. So, yeah, it really wasn't a large turnout. And he is the first white man elected since 1969. That was Roman Gribbs, who was elected that year. He only won by 7,000 votes. And in 1973, Coleman Young came in. He was the first African-American mayor of the city, and he stayed in office for 20 years. Now, since his term ended in 1993, all of the mayors since then have been corporate-oriented and have been more geared towards appealing to Wall Street for investment. Dave Bing came in 4 years ago, and he was promoted by the corporate media the same way that Mike Duggan was, as a businessman who could make difficult decisions. And his tenure, of course, was not even satisfactory to the people who had encouraged him and funded him and put him in office. So the same situation will, in all likelihood, be true of Mike Duggan as well, because they have no real solution to the crisis other than refinancing the existing debt, creating more debt, and doing more downsizing. And there's no real discussion about how to really improve issues in the city.
Duggan has set up a transition group, and it looks like it's got a fair representation of African-Americans. Do you have concerns, nonetheless, about the transition group?
Oh, most definitely. As I mentioned before, Duggan does not have a reputation of being union-friendly. Neither does he have a reputation of being an effective manager of a public entity such as the city of Detroit. It's not like running a medical center. He took a nonprofit entity and transformed it into a private corporation. It's a lot more difficult to do that with a city. I mean, I believe that's their objective. In terms of the governor, the emergency manager, and the banks and corporations that they work for. But it remains to be seen if they'll be able to carry out that program because it's not the same thing managing a corporation and managing a municipality. And that is the problem he's going to have. He's going to meet opposition from significant segments of the population who didn't vote for him or who didn't vote at all. And when they see the program that he's going to institute, people are definitely going to turn against it because they have no solution. They're not talking about creating jobs. They're not talking about improving. They talk about improving city services, but it's only being talked about within the context of more privatization. And in terms of the pensions and the health care programs and the jobs of city employees, they're still going to be up for grabs, even if the bankruptcy is not approved in federal court.
When Duggan was running, as was Betty Napoleon, Is there a sense that there's something of a priority list with respect to Detroiters, where what's the uppermost issue to tackle? Is there some discussion as to what the priorities are and what the interests of Detroiters are?
Yeah, I think jobs, the elimination of crime, improvement of city services, particularly the bus service, which is in an abysmal state. Yes, emergency medical services, which are also highly dysfunctional because of the budget cutbacks. Yeah, I think these are the main issues that they're concerned about here in Detroit.
You are affiliated with a group, Moratorium Now, seeking to put an end, or at least put a long pause in foreclosures, evictions, and utility cutoffs. How are you and how is your group working with Duggan so far? Or what do you expect to get from Duggan with respect to the interests of Moratorium Now?
Well, we expect that there will be more attacks on the unions. We expect to receive no real program for the improvement of city services. And, of course, if there's no improvement in the economic conditions of people, crime will continue to skyrocket in the city. So we have no illusions about who Duggan is and who he works for, in the same sense that Dave Bain or Kwame Kilpatrick or Dennis Archer before them really had no program for the rebuilding of the cities. This is a national problem, the lack of investment by the federal government, by state governments, by private industry and finance. They have not invested in the infrastructure of the cities, for example, the public lighting systems, the power systems, not enough housing, affordable housing for people. And public transportation, too, has been a wholesale disinvestment in public transportation since 2009. So these are the real issues that need to be addressed. And most of the mayors that are coming to power now are not really addressing these issues. They're not running on these issues. So it's a major problem.
Perhaps it is because they are cognizant of the fact that the way the political system is arranged now, with a state-appointed manager, emergency manager, making all decisions, really, that even with a new mayor, even with new members elected to the city council, the power, the actual power to do things that typically would accrue to the city council, to the mechanisms of government that are elected by the people, that for the time being, none of that holds any water. That, you know, the state appointed emergency manager is, you know, the Lord of Lords in Detroit at the moment. So
yeah,
how does the mayor then get, having been elected, how does he affirm his power? Does he have to apply to a court to get the power that accrues to being a mayor?
Well, right now everything is in the hands of the federal bankruptcy court, and that's a major problem because the emergency management law gives all authority to the EM.
Did we lose him again? Say it ain't so. There's a problem. Look, you know, we're just going to have to cope with it. If we keep trying, we'll continue the conversation. There's a problem on his end, a major problem with the phone. So we'll try to see how we can reestablish contact and continue the conversation. But what you're hearing so far is a very interesting story, and it is important to pay attention to Detroit because Detroit is in many ways being used as a test case for controlling major urban centers. And people know what that means. It means areas that usually you find If you were to strip away all of the undesirable elements, you'd find a perfect pattern for completely redesigning a city in a brand new light. All you have to do is to just get people out of the way. By whatever means, just get them out of the way. Detroit is saddled with an $18 billion debt, and it is currently in bankruptcy court seeking legal permission to declare bankruptcy, which is, of course, what the fight is all about. If it does declare bankruptcy, there are massive, massive consequences, especially dealing with retirees and pension funds and so forth. And that's on one level. But on the other level, Detroit's population now is less than half of what it used to be, hovering close to about 700,000. And that means a massive, an exodus has occurred. Okay, we got him back. We both need to get gold stars for tenacity today.
Yeah, I'm telling you. I don't know how long we'll be here.
But just pick up from where you left off.
You were mentioning about the population. When the last white mayor was elected to Detroit in 1969, the city had 1.4 million people. So the population has been halved since then. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Hello? Yes. You hear me? Okay. So that's the point I was making, yes. Yeah, the population has been cut in half since 1969 in Detroit.
So we were talking about the rights that accrue to a mayor. Okay, a new mayor comes in and he has some great ideas, and he's got this transition team and whatnot, and there's the various expectations from various parts of the constituencies in Detroit. But he cannot affirm the authority commensurate with his position as an elected official until the court decides it. Who gets to say that who gets a green light to him as being a real bona fide mayor?
Yeah, well, the hearing, the trial for the bankruptcy to determine whether the city is eligible for bankruptcy. And as I mentioned when I talked to you before, it was not the city officials who filed for bankruptcy. It was done through the governor's office by the emergency manager. So the trial was over last Friday, and the judge has still not rendered a decision as to whether Detroit is eligible for bankruptcy. It has to be determined that it's insolvent, and also that the emergency manager had to have negotiated in good faith with all the creditors, not just the banks and the insurance companies and vendors, but also the unions and the retirees and their representatives. So that's what the judge has to determine. But there's still some hearings that are going on. There was one today there was a motion filed to keep secret the fees that Barclays Bank will receive for this new deal to pay off the swaps prior to a decision being made whether or not the bankruptcy is legitimate and can go forward. So that was a hearing on that today. On December 10th, there's going to be a hearing on the overall swap deal that Barclays is supposed to provide $350 million in financing to pay off Bank of America and United Bank of Switzerland for their credit default swaps claimed to be owed by the city of Detroit to them.
Well, this is what I'd like you to.
There's still a lot of hearings that will take place.
I'd like you, Abayomi, to explain, because this has been where actually I engaged with you in your work and the work of Moratorium Now in exposing the role of the banks in the precipitous decline of the economy in Detroit. Could you explain what that is, what the relationship is between the banking community and the situation that the bankruptcy, the pending bankruptcy of Detroit?
Yeah, well, there was a targeting of Detroit, like other majority African-American communities and Latino communities around the country, for predatory lending. And that came maybe 15 years ago. But even prior to that, we had large-scale outsourcing of jobs. And that took a lot of employment out of the cities. And, of course, when people don't have jobs, They can't spend money as much, and they can lose their homes, even absent of predatory lending, and they move to look for jobs elsewhere. And then when the tax revenue goes down, then the city is forced to borrow at high interest rates, and then it just compounds the problem even more. So that's what we have going on in Detroit, and it's happening in other cities as well. And then the whole issue of funding, underfunded pensions, they're utilizing it to justify major cuts in city budgets, and also threatening the pension payments to the retirees, as well as other benefits that retirees were guaranteed through negotiations with the city of Detroit. And the pensions are backed up as well by the Michigan Constitution. So this is a major decision that Judge Rose is going to render in the next few weeks.
The city of Detroit has experienced an alarming number of foreclosures. I just wanted you to make the connection between that phrase, predatory lending, and why the foreclosure rate in Detroit was so high to the point where huge tracts of land in Detroit are occupied by either the rubble of buildings that used to be there or empty properties that have been abandoned via foreclosure.
Yes, well, the loans were loans that could never be paid off because many of them had adjustable rate mortgages, the so-called ARMs, which, you know, the rates would readjust during the course of the early years of the mortgage. Someone may start off paying $600 a month or $800 a month, and within a year and a half or 2 years, they could be paying as much as $2,200 a month. So this was allowed to take place, and these mortgages were bundled, and they were placed under control of securitized trust, and they were serviced by the largest banks in the world, Chase, Bank of America, UBS. They all had a hand in this, Royal Bank of Scotland, Charter One Bank, PNC Bank. There were so many of them because it was a very high profit-making enterprise. But it all blew up about 5 or 6 years ago. And the government had to bail out the banks, and the Federal Reserve is continuing to bail out the banks. So, yes, this is why people lost their homes. And you can go around the city and you can find many vacant homes. A lot of them have been put up for auction. And there are people buying them in the dozens and the hundreds. But still, it's very difficult to find people to rent these homes or to repurchase these homes because of the lack of jobs and the lack of income.
You're at ground level at this thing, and you see the, in a sense, you see the end result of the chaos that occurred at an administrative level and among parties that have vested interests in Detroit. As awful as the situation is, there's a lot of money still to be made.
Yes.
What do you think is the ultimate plan for Detroit? Why is it going through this process, and what will come out at the other end of this period that Detroit is going through?
Well, I think it's a system that is in terminal crisis, meaning the overall economy inside the United States, and they're looking for whatever way possible to make profits, as they did through the predatory mortgage lending schemes. And, of course, now with the municipal finance schemes, municipal bonds are now a $3.7 trillion industry. So there's a lot of money involved in this. And they want to, of course, attack municipal unions to virtually outlaw them so they cannot function. And in doing that, there's no obligation for the municipalities to have health care programs, educational programs, retirement programs that mean, you know, anything that's significant. And then in doing that, they can bring in private companies to ostensibly manage city services. And we see it happening all over the country. We've already seen it in the public educational system, where now with charter schools and private schools, money is being drained from public education. Thousands upon thousands of teachers are being laid off in the United States, having their pay cut, benefits cut. So this is the overall scheme that's going on. And our head of Michigan, according to Bloomberg's in a recent article, there are 18 other states that have pension funds that are claimed to be worse in terms of their funding than the state of Michigan. Illinois is at the top of the list. Kentucky is number two. And Michigan, as I said, is either 18th or 19th. So you can see all of these states are subjected to similar policies as are going on here in the city of Detroit. They want to, of course, say that the pension funds are unsustainable and that they have no choice except to cut pensions and to also cut benefits for retirees. But the problem is the state constitutions, even in Illinois, have guaranteed protections for pensions, as they do in Michigan. So they have to go through a bankruptcy process because federal law trumps state law. So this is what they're banking on right now, is using the federal bankruptcy courts to eliminate guaranteed pensions and fundamental rights for workers and residents of municipalities.
But is there a grand design?
Yes.
What is it?
Yes. Well, I believe it's a society in which the majority of the people have less power, have less authority, and that you create even a greater class division within society in general. We see that happening. The wealth is becoming more and more concentrated inside the United States, and there are more and more people who are poor who self-identify as poor. There was a survey taken earlier this year indicating that half the people in the United States are either in poverty or consider themselves to be in poverty or near poverty. So they want to continue this same process. That's their long-term objective as a means of addressing the economic crisis in the United States and indeed the world. We see it happening in other countries, in Southern Europe, you know, where they've cut pensions and where there's full-blown austerity in places like Greece and Spain and Portugal and in other European countries. And it's coming at a more rapid rate here in the United States as well.
Can Detroit really work itself out of an $18 billion debt?
No, I don't see that happening unless a large portion of the debt is canceled, because there's no way the residents in this city can pay back $18 to $22 billion. It's just impossible. Even if they liquidated the entire city budget and outsourced, you know, the water services, bus services, garbage collection services, eliminated all these city assets and sold them off, it still wouldn't be enough to satisfy the banks and the bondholders and the corporations.
So what then is the answer?
That's the only way out.
So what is a workable plan? If Detroit has $18 billion in debt, bankruptcy affords it to discharge the debt under the supervision of the court in particular ways, and of course the conditions, as you earlier had said, include evidence that there was a good faith effort to negotiate with the unions and the pension plans and so forth. But nonetheless, even if they were able to work out these arrangements, and you were saying that there's no way that Detroit, as it exists today, could actually climb out of $18 billion of debt. So then what is the alternative?
Well, the only real alternative is to eliminate most of the debt, but the banks don't want that, and the bond insurers don't want it. So it's going to be a struggle because the program that they have is unworkable. Because you have to have people to run the city. The city would not run automatically. So they have to have people to run the city, but if they're not willing to pay people And if people have no benefits, then it's going to be almost impossible to run the city. And I don't believe that they can get private entities to conduct city business efficiently. We've seen it in the school systems. The charter schools, there's really no monitoring, there's no evaluation of their performance. It's all ideologically driven, and it will be the same thing in terms of city services as well. And it's already been a tremendous amount of privatization in municipal services, not just in Detroit, but also around the country. And the conditions of the cities fundamentally have not improved. You still have most cities in the United States now that are facing some type of fiscal crisis, whether it's related to legacy costs such as pensions and health care, or it could be related to the loss in population, the loss in jobs, the disinvestment by the federal government and state governments in municipalities. So it has to be a total reorientation in regard to priorities in the United States. There has to be a reinvestment in the cities and in the small towns, the suburbs, the rural areas. And we don't see that happening. Most of the money has been siphoned off by Wall Street and by the Pentagon. That's where a lot of the money is going. And there's no real plan on the part of those who have authority and power inside U.S. society to change any of that. That's why it was so interesting during the height of the Occupy movement 2 years ago that the Wall Street ideologues really had no response to the Occupy Wall Street movement because their position is essentially indefensible. So it was quite interesting that they could only attack the movement that it was a nuisance, was, you know, impeding, you know, the city's functioning, but they could not respond to the existence of the movement or any of the demands that were being put forward by the Occupy movement. So I think that's a reflection of where the ruling interests are right now. They really don't have a plan, and, you know, things like creating jobs are not generally discussed. Poverty is not discussed. So this is the problem that people in the U.S. are facing now.
Well, something came into focus just last week about, and it was really a very sad situation, and I'm referring to the shooting death of Renisha McBride. Could you explain the impact that this particular case, just give us the briefing about the case and the impact this case has had in the throes of Detroit going through its own troubles, the never-ending reminder of racial collisions and how these things can work for political benefit. Could you talk about the Renisha McBride case?
Yeah, it's been devastating for people in this area and around the country. It's really got international attention. It's a 19-year-old African-American woman on the morning of November 2nd was apparently in a car accident in a majority white suburb, Dearborn Heights. And apparently she was wandering around looking for assistance. She went up to someone's house and knocked on the door or knocked on the window, and she wound up being shot in the face. It was really a horrible situation. She died. And the person, the homeowner who fired the shot that killed her, has not been indicted, has not been arrested. It's claiming that it was an accident. So, you know, that's where that situation stands right now. But there's been demonstrations at the home. There's been demonstrations at the Dearborn Heights Police Station. Yeah, so it's a lot of shock as well as anger surrounding the Renisha McBride case. But it's indicative of the overall character, racist violence, and intolerance that's going on right now inside the United States. The Kendrick Johnson case in Georgia, and the Trayvon Martin, the verdict of George Zimmerman. It appears as if black lives are still valued far less than the lives of the dominant and majority culture in the United States.
Well, Abayomi, thank you so much. You were a trooper today, even though the cell phone towers were not necessarily very friendly to you. But thanks so much for sticking it through and bringing us up to date on Detroit. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
All right.
Well, bye-bye. Well, I wanted to talk a bit about President Obama again, come back to the issue of Obamacare before we take off, just a few words on that. You know, it is unfortunate that we're having these kinds of discussions, the ex post facto discussions. You know, first you make a law, and Nancy Pelosi had said that, and we talked about that some time ago, where she said, you know, she can't tell even legislators what's in the law. First you've got to vote for it, and then you'll know what's in it, she said. And this is a kind of sarcastic way and the attitude of leadership in this country. They do not understand that they are public servants to serve the public. They're there thinking that Congress, the House and the Senate are, you know, like private clubs. And they happen to be members of this elite club, and you don't need to know what they're doing. They're smart, which is a definitive and signature word for the Obama administration. A lot of things, you know, very smart. Smart people doing smart diplomacy and smart policy making, because they're also very smart. Well, here's what happens. When you conspire is really the best word. When you conspire to do things in an underhanded way, and this is how this particular law came into being, it was done in secret from the very beginning. But by all the smart people, it was hustled through. It never came out of a committee. We talked at length. I talked at length about it here. This bill never came up for debate in Congress the way it's now being debated after it's, quote, a fact of law. And people are compelled to obey what, in effect, is an illegal and just outrageous law. But it is, quote, law. And it became law in a very dishonest process. And the ramifications of which we will never know until somebody gets to it. It is so convoluted. It is so absolutely complicated. And it is evidence of what lawyers do when they sit down. Corporate lawyers, when they sit down, they think of every single possibility, every possible permutation that the law or the interests might be challenged on. And then they write all kinds of legal verbiage to protect that and to close up those loopholes. This Obamacare is not a health care legislation. This has nothing to do about improving your health or even delivering competent medical services to the people. It is insurance, the government being in the insurance business and allowing the insurance community to author all kinds of things that would work to its advantage. So they were calling the shots from day one. The legislative piece, which is really where the president should have come in, which is, to what degree are we helping people? This is not it. This legislation is not it. This is nothing about helping you and me. This is about, well, if an insurance company gets a pool of people, if the law could be used to command people to form a consumer group, which is what it is, the law in this sense, the state, is acting like, you know, in those old Western movies where you have the cowboys rounding up the cattle for a long cattle drive. That's what this law is. the consumers are the cattle. Just round them up and make sure they go into a particular field or go a particular way they want them to go, in whatever direction. You get the dogs that herd the sheep and the cowboys who just rustle everybody together and they keep the thing moving in the direction they want the cattle to go. That's what this is. The government has taken it upon itself to create a consumer group upon which the insurance community is going to feed for a very long time. And the only reason they're doing this is because money is involved. It may not be money they're getting now, but you can be sure that they will be adequately compensated for doing this great favor. The president is the best lobbyist that the insurance companies have ever had. And he inherited that from the Clintons, because this essentially is the Clinton plan. And as I said, it was done in secret. So what happens is they pass a law, and now they're realizing all the things that could possibly go wrong, and it's not going to stop now. It's going to be ad infinitum. Things are going to be wrong with this because it was not even conceived in an atmosphere of debate, transparency. Hello? No transparency at all about this so-called law. It never happened. It never came out of a committee. It never was openly discussed. These things were never ironed out in the way that you're supposed to do in a so-called democratic society. This is the kind of law that is associated with the most backward, corrupt governments. This is this law. And all those folks, including Nancy Pelosi and her lovely little pearls, they're all acting like little dictators down there in Washington. They can do whatever they want. So they made up a law. The president, of course, has to act almost like the Pope. He's infallible. You can't question the veracity and the sanity of this law. It came out of smart people. Smart people don't make mistakes. So now they had a huge problem, and now they're going to put a patch on it. And guess what? The patch is itself a reason to question the patch. So you'll have people challenging the patch, and then they will find another patch to patch this patch. And this is how it will go on. People need to be really clear. This is the single most disgusting, vile, corrupt piece of legislation to come along in a long, long time. It is disgusting. It is so undemocratic. It is so corrupt. It is so wrong on so many levels. It's running a snow job on all Americans, thinking, well, you know, hey, now you have medical care. No, you don't. You have an insurance policy. That's all you have. And it may not even be good. It may not even be the best thing for you. But you are ordered to have it, or else they will, you know, fine you. And then the next step is they'll put you in jail. You know, the kind of stuff we hear that, you know, these dictatorial countries do, how they abuse their citizens and how they take the rights of citizens away. This is what we're seeing here. It comes with a lot of red, white, and blue and a lot of fanfare. But make no mistake, this law is anti-human. This law is anti-citizen. This law is anti-consumer. This law is just plain illegal. And people are fixated about, they've turned this whole discussion onto whether it is about it's about the website that's not looking. It's not about a website. Although by even in there, you see the law is not followed. How do you award a couple of $100 million to a company without a bid? How does that happen? There was a no-bid process. Somebody certainly had the favor of the people who make the decisions. And they still can't get it right. But they're several hundred millions of dollars richer. That's the disgusting thing. The money they spent just to erect the website could have provided very competent care if people were in the business of actually caring about the people of the United States. You spent literally by the time this is over, it would be in the billions of dollars to just put up a computer site, a website, in this day and age in the United States. Okay? That's embarrassing. But the fundamental problem here is that this law is wrong. It is illegal. And it was born in the crucible of deception and treachery and corruption. That's the problem with this law. Any law that has regulations attached to it that are more than 7 feet high, that's just the regulations. The bill itself is 2,700 pages. You know automatically there's something major that's wrong with this. Like a bunch of vampires, these people got together and decided, hey, we could cook up a nice little recipe that would keep us in the money for a very long time. All we need is to just shove these unthinking Americans into the meat grinder. That's all we need is the numbers. You buy the policy, and yet, okay, so you buy a policy. That doesn't mean you could use it. It doesn't mean you could afford to use it. So you will buy a policy you can't afford to use. It's as simple as that. The state decided to create its own monopoly and to go into the insurance business and to compel you to fit into whatever crooked scheme they have cooked up to reward the people who gave them a lot of money. And it's not over. As smart as these people are, you will see how stupid and short-sighted they really have been by thinking that they can, you know, they get in under the radar. Wow, we've made this. We've made it so far. That's fantastic. And people are really thinking it's the law because you, again, this is a form of abuse that attaches to Mr. Obama. You misused your authority to abuse the people. You make it possible for them to be punished for not fitting into your plan to reward the insurance industry that wrote the plan. This, I think this one thing alone is the basis for saying goodbye to the Republicans, goodbye to the Democrats forever. But we will see more and more of this. And people are going to come as Nancy Pelosi did today with her lovely little beads. And she's talking, well, you know, there's a fix going in and repatching this. This is the same woman who has asked a reporter, I played the tape for you, why are we even discussing this, she says. What difference does it make, she says. Vote for this and then we can tell you what's in it. That's the attitude these people have. And they insist, they dress up with their red, white, and blue lapel pins and the trappings of patriotism. But they're the vilest creatures. And in the world of hypocrites, the hippoest crits. I think there ought to be a general objection. The whole country should refuse, absolutely refuse to register for this law. Register for Obamacare. Absolutely refuse to do it. This is unconstitutional. I don't care what they say. I don't care how many times they invoke the U.S. Supreme Court. I have a ready answer for them. The U.S. Supreme Court is not supreme and only need to revisit some of its more wonderful decisions to get at that. There's more than ample proof that these folks at the U.S. Supreme Court aren't supreme at all. So that's my take on this thing. I think we ought to see it for what it is. It is reason, I think, to absolutely condemn both parties, but more so the Democratic Party, since this travesty came out of their scrambled brains and their corrupt desires and the insistence that they're so smart they can abuse people and still make them believe that this is what is being done in an orderly and lawful fashion. Wrong. It's the biggest lie ever. And if Barack Obama were ever to be tagged with the label of deceiver and liar, this law is the reason. I'm really fundamental about it because I'm not even talking about this website. And by the way, somebody should raise a question about how do you award a contract this huge without a bid? Nobody's talking about EEO standards here and whether it was a fair process and whether so-called minorities participated as contractors. A big, huge federal bid to build all this computer stuff, and you get it without having to bid for the contract. It means corruption occurred right there. So, I have done my task for the day. We'll join each other tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening.